That's where you are on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Yesterday marked 6 years since the Bali bombings. That's the day when 202 people, including 88 Australians, died when terrorists attacked two nightclubs in Kuta. Hours after the bombings, thousands struggled to leave the island with airlines unable to cope with a mass exodus. But as tourists fled, journalists flocked, like Sadanan Dume. He was on assignment for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Asian Wall Street Journal. It was in the darkness of the Bali aftermath that he wrote his first book, My Friend the Fanatic, a travelogue and memoir that charts the rise of radical Islam in Indonesia. His story begins in the devastation of Kuta, and that's where The Book Show's Linda Lopresti asked Sadanan Dume to begin reading from My Friend the Fanatic.
The sun had barely set when I reached Kuta, but it felt like the still before dawn. I walked past Bounty Bar, shaped like a pirate schooner and as deserted as a shipwreck. A bikini-clad mannequin stared out of a surfing equipment store's darkened window. Ahead of me, a small band of stay-behinds, their thongs and floral shirts at odds with their ashen faces, trudged toward a yellow-taped police barricade. I flashed my press card. I was here as a reporter for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Asian Wall Street Journal, and ducked under the tape. Soldiers and policemen, machine guns slung from their shoulders, stood in a knot, puffing on Kretex, clove cigarettes. Behind them stood a small Haagen-Dazs truck, its roof depressed as though it had been stepped on by a giant. The driver, I later learned, had been decapitated by the blast while he idled in traffic. Ground Zero smelled of gasoline and burnt wood. Uprooted tables, blackened beer bottles, and mangled red plastic beer crates dotted the ashes of what had been the Sari Club the night before. Cars parked in front had been reduced to junkyard wrecks. The Balinese had already visited, leaving behind maroon, white, and orange flowers in delicate banana leaf baskets, their appeasement for the gods. For a while, searching for some trace of a human being, a shoe, a bracelet, a severed hand, I followed the spotlight of a video camera manned by another latecomer to the scene. But the site had already been cleaned up and all that remained was rubble. More than 200 people died in the attacks. A smaller backpack bomb at Paddy's Bar across the street had preceded the massive car bomb that did most of the damage. 3 months later, they would fill 140 bags with unidentified body parts for burial. But on that night, it was as though the dead had been vaporized, leaving behind only ash and glass and plastic.
Sadanan Dume reading the opening page of My Friend the Fanatic. That's a very disturbing scene you paint there, Sadanan. Was that a defining moment for you in terms of wanting to know more about why this happened and I guess how this could happen in a largely secular nation like Indonesia? Because it wasn't long after those attacks that you quit your job as a journalist with the Far Eastern Economic Review and you began travelling around Indonesia and began writing this book.
That's true. You know, the scene, it was a haunting scene and it would not leave me. And I felt that what was behind this, you know, the engine, what could produce such mayhem in a country that was really famous the world over for being so easygoing and tolerant and not the last place in the Muslim world you would expect to have something like this happen. And what I sensed was that this was much deeper than just a random group of violent young men, that the terrorism was a symptom of a much larger and much deeper social churning. And that's what I set out to discover in this book.
It's interesting, though, the 6 years on, we have the bombers, Imam Samudra Mukhlas and Amrozi. Amrozi once dubbed the smiling assassin. They're still laughing and talking freely about revenge attacks if they're executed, you know, saying it's the religious duty of Muslims to wage jihad, almost acting like pop stars instead of prisoners. And it's a disturbing paradox, and yet I saw one which is quite common in your book, My Friend the Fanatic, because you introduce us to characters like Janair, whom you describe as a wild child of Indonesian literature. She smokes, she drinks, she's not shy about her sexuality. And then, of course, there's the protagonist, Heri Nurdi, the Muslim fundamentalist. Do they represent the real Indonesia?
Yes, they do. And I think it's important not to generalize too much, but at the same time, not to shy away from the fact that there are very, very diverse and dizzyingly opposite characters in this large country of 220 million people. So on the one hand, you have a kind of free-for-all, anything-goes form of westernization. But on the other hand, you have some of the darkest currents of the Arab Islamic world that have also found a home in Indonesia. And what I tried to look at was to look at both of these and see how they come together in this country.
Well, tell us about Harry, who is your friend, the fanatic, who hero worships Osama bin Laden and Abu Bakr Bashir, the leader of al-Qaeda's local franchise, Jama'a Islamiyah. What made you decide to make him the focus of your story?
You know, Harry was really my entry into this very strange world, and a world to which, as you would imagine, foreigners, and especially non-Muslims, don't normally have access. Now, at the time, he was the managing editor of a fundamentalist, Saudi-funded magazine called Sabili, which put Bashir on the cover and named him Man of the Year just a couple of months after the Bali bombing, just to give you a sense of where they're coming from. And he himself is an interesting character, and in some ways he is emblematic of the changes in Indonesia, in the sense that somebody who holds such violent political views would not have existed, say, 30 years ago. But on the other hand, he's also different from some of the other fundamentalists I met, in the sense that he was, I found, somewhat less dogmatic. And at one stage, he tells me that he's really just a Monday to Friday fundamentalist, and on the weekends he likes watching Hollywood movies.
Well, there's a real difference, though, between fanaticism and terrorism, isn't there? I mean, would you agree that one doesn't necessarily translate into the other? I mean, for me, that point was brought home through Harry. As you say, he's a fundamentalist Monday through to Friday, but not on the weekend.
I'm not any kind of fundamentalist any day of the
no,
week.
No, no. But do you think that there is a Western misconception that fanaticism equals terrorism?
To a large extent. And my concern really is that we don't worry enough about the nonviolent fundamentalists, and we worry too much about the terrorists. In the end, a small percentage of the Muslim population is fundamentalist, and an even smaller percentage of the fundamentalists are terrorists. And it's the people who really would never themselves strap a bomb on and go to a bar, but who in many ways would approve of such behavior, or in Harry's case, egg it on, who occupy this gray zone. A lot of people, a lot of journalists, and a lot of people in the think tanks and so on don't pay that much attention to that element. But that's the element that, to me, is growing very rapidly, and that is cause for the greatest concern. And these are not people who are violent themselves, but they certainly don't have any problem with violence committed in the name of Islam.
Well, you spent a lot of time with Harry. He opened doors for you, and you crisscrossed Indonesia with him. Were you frustrated by his views, by his fundamentalist views? Because you yourself say that you're an atheist. In the book you say, my atheism arrived at by instinct was largely unexamined. Surrounded by the pious for the first time in my life, I couldn't help but revisit my own attitudes towards God and religion. Did he make you think twice?
Well, you know, I developed a real fondness for him. And this is partly because I really did come to agree with his self-description that he was Monday to Friday fanatic and a liberal on the weekends. I'm not sure I'd use the word liberal, but he was certainly, there was more to him. He didn't have a closed mind. He had some pretty disturbing views, and he had a vision of his country, which I disagree with profoundly. But he was a person who, in the end, I could have a conversation with. There were many other people I met during the course of my journeys who were people you couldn't really have a conversation with, because they didn't have any more questions. They had only answers. And so those people were much more disturbing to me than Harry, even though Harry is the central character.
People, I guess, like Abu Bakr Bashir, who you met through Harry, he opened that door for you to meet him. Now, Bashir, as we said, is the leader of the Southeast Asian terror group Jama'a Islamiyah. You describe your meeting with him halfway through the book. Can you read us that passage?
Yes, you know, he was in prison at the time, and it was very difficult to see him. But Harry, having impeccable connections with the likes of Bashir, managed to smuggle me into his jail cell, and here's a description then. He wore a green sarong with a white tunic and a white scarf tossed over a shoulder. A pair of large wire-rimmed glasses sat above a thick tuft of white beard. A beaten steel watch circled his wrist. He exuded an avuncular air. To my surprise, after all the press reports that described a foaming madman, his eyes reflected intelligence and calm. Harry introduced me with a slight bow. "He's from India, Ustad." Ustad was a term of respect, Arabic for teacher. "Does he speak Indonesian?" asked Bashir. I couldn't help notice the teeth, yellowed and prominent as a camel's. "Yes, Ustad." Bashir signaled his approval with a slight nod. He sat with his back to a wall beside a barred iron door. We took places on a bench across from him, our backs against the opposite wall. A faded lace cloth covered a low glass-topped table between us. On it sat a plastic jar with sugar-dusted biscuits, a fried peanut snack, and small bottles of water. The Mujahideen Council crew we had seen earlier began making its way from the police desks to our end of the room. The skull-capped men, wispy beards, prayer calluses, a few in Mujahideen Council t-shirts, filed past Bashir with great deference, each pausing to embrace his gaunt hand in a two-handed clasp. Then they shook hands with Harry and with me. Their hands were limp, a concession of sorts to Java, where a handshake too firm was considered impolite. The jilbabs on the shapeless robed women spilled across their chests like giant bibs. Not one revealed a wisp of hair. A mother settled down on a bench and dandled an infant in powder blue and a white jilbab on her knee. Another jilbabbed girl, maybe 4 or 5 years old, played with the infant's leg. Even in Iran they didn't cover up girls this young. Nonetheless, the women gave the scene a touch of domesticity. If you took away the iron bars and the police on the other side of the room, it might have been a picnic. The children, the sugar-dusted cookies, the plastic bag with oranges and noodles. Nobody interrupted Bashir while he spoke, evenly and with the practiced ease of a preacher. He spoke about the enemies of Islam, about America, about how some Muslim leaders supported the kafirs, supported America, the enemy of Islam. But they would all lose in the end because God had said that Islam would triumph over the kafirs and there would be a caliphate for all Muslims.
It's that them and us mentality, isn't it?
Entirely. He calls it, he says it's between Satan and God, or as he put it, between carrots and steak, the choice.
And did you find that a recurring theme as you travelled through Indonesia?
Well, you know, Bashir is, of course, one extreme. He's emblematic of this. And by and large, I would say that Indonesians, that kind of black and whiteness that Bashir represents does not come naturally to Indonesians. They're sort of much more comfortable somewhere in the middle. But what I did see was that more and more people were receptive to Bashir's kind of message, even though they themselves would not have approached his fanaticism.
Yet it's that black and white image which you just described that I found quite recurring in your book. For example, the former actress Astra Evo, you described she looked like a cross between a Palestinian suicide bomber and a prosperous Punjabi housewife. Did you find that as you were writing it, did you find that there was a theme happening?
Yeah, I mean, the theme really is that how can a country that is so vast and so known for its tolerant, easygoing folk Islam become home to this Saudi-ized version? And of course, that's not the majority. It's even now it's a minority. I have to stress that. But it's a minority which a generation ago people would have laughed at you if you said that it would take hold in Indonesia.
Well, I'm curious as to know what Harry thinks of the book. In the final pages, you write, "A few shreds of the personal bond remained, but our political differences had grown starker." Is Harry happy to be known as your friend, the fanatic?
No, he's quite unhappy with the book. He feels that I guess his main problem was that he feels that there is too much about him, and that I haven't been kind, and that's of course true. That I haven't been kind to the Islamist movement.
Were you kind to him?
I believe I was fair to him. And if you go by the reviews, both in the Australian and in the Asian press, they've overwhelmingly said that I have been sympathetic to him, yes.
And have you seen him since leaving?
I haven't. We've spoken on the phone and we've exchanged emails.
Right.
But I haven't seen him face to face since.
All right. Well, you're now in the throes of writing a new book, a non-fiction book about India. Are you more optimistic about India than you are about Indonesia, or do you see some parallels between these two nations?
Well, I am. Well, yes to both. I am more optimistic. I think India is opening itself up to the world after shutting out the world for about 35 years. And I think this process of India being knit back into the English-speaking world is very good for India and very good for democracies. On the other hand, I am not nearly as optimistic about India as most Indians are. It's a tremendously poor country, and it is struggling to surmount very, very large problems. And so I think that the sense of euphoria and the sense of giddiness that comes through in much of the coverage of India is certainly something that I do not share, though I am broadly optimistic. And, you know, it really comes down to a question of what you're comparing it with. Now, when you look at a very large country like India, and it's still for the most part, an inward-looking culture, you know, it's got its own movies and its own obsessions with sports and everything else, the tendency is to compare India with its own past. And if you make that comparison, clearly things are better than they were before. However, if you compare India with the countries of Southeast Asia and North Asia, you realize that India is still a very poor place that's struggling in many, many ways. And I think many Indians are not quite aware of that.
Sadanand Dume speaking from Washington, D.C. to our Linda Lopresti. And Sadanand will discuss the rise of radical Islam in the Muslim world at the Ubud Writers' Festival, which begins this week in Bali. My Friend the Fanatic is published by Text.